All right. This is the second half of the players and coaches conference. We're going to be focusing, I think, more on player improvement, how to accomplish that, what your various paths are, and if you know, there's other questions towards the end, we'd be happy to answer those too. But we're going to go ahead and get started with Max Schindler. Max has won national championships. That's the proper note with Ledoux in the high school level before. Did you guys actually win anything this year?
No, because of Eric.
Okay, get your act together. So we'll go ahead and get started, Max.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Max. I play Quiz Bowl, like all of you. So I'm going to be talking about how to get better as a player. I mostly structured this talk to talk about sort of moving from being like a very good regional player to being like a very good like national player. Sort of, I'm assuming this is the caliber that like almost everyone in this room is because you're at the NSC. If you want me to talk about, you know, like the jump before that from going from like all right to like pretty good in your region, then I'd be happy to do that in the question and answer session. So I'm not going to be talking too much about actual specific techniques because I found that, you know, it varies a lot from person to person. I think it'd be very silly for me to come up here and assume that I have a better knowledge of your learning style than you do. So I'm sort of going to talk about how, what I do and how I like think about it from like a meta level approaching studying. And the reason I do this is sort of, I don't know how much time everyone spends on studying, but like when I was in high school, it was on the order of dozens of hours a week, like, you know, my like senior year when I was really hitting Quiz Bowl really hard. So that works out to, I don't know, 50 times like 10, 20. That's like 500 to 1,000 hours a year. And if I can spend like 3 hours sitting down and thinking about how to make myself 10% more productive, then I gain 100 hours for the cost of three, which is like a pretty good increase in my study time. So I always encourage people to, before you really start gearing down and studying, you know, if you decide you want to get really, really good at Quiz Bowl or even just study a little bit, I always encourage you to sort of step back and like make a plan for what you want to do, make your goals, come up with a good approach for doing it. Because if you just sort of plow ahead blindly the way you've always been doing it before, it'll probably work. It just won't be the most efficient way you can spend your time. And I think spending your time efficiently is almost more important than just spending a lot of time on Quiz Bowl. Because, you know, if someone's working three times as smart as you, even if you're working twice as hard as them, they're going to like outpace you by a lot. I guess the way I approach thinking about studying is, first off, I think bonuses are kind of like, the way I just approach winning games is you want to win games by getting the most toss-ups. Bonuses don't really matter too much from the perspective of like winning games. So you want to optimize for getting toss-ups, right? Because like if you get 12 of the toss-ups in a game, I don't care how bad you're doing on the bonuses, you're almost certainly going to win, even at pace where everything bounces back. Like even 11 to 9 on toss-up splits, you should probably win that game. And if you're actually really studying well, then you're going to get good enough that you're not like doing horribly on bonuses. So I always encourage like thinking about it from a perspective of how do I get the toss-ups I need to win. And the way I model toss-ups in my head is like, all right, we've got this answer line and we've got about 10 clues for this answer line. And, you know, I want to buzz on one of the clues that comes up before the other guy can buzz. And that's like a very simple approach. And I know all of you have probably thought about it that way, but it's like a really powerful way to think about it because it reduces the question of like winning games to just like knowing more clues than everyone else and being able to, not just knowing more clues, being able to buzz on more clues. And the way I've found that I like to think about it is there's really sort of three steps you need to like actually buzz on a toss-up. First, you have to like kind of know the existence. Like, so to buzz on a toss-up, right, unless you're like lateraling it somehow or frauding it or taking a random guess, you really have to know what's going on. And to know what's going on, there's like a three-step process of execution. First, you have to actually have like heard the clue that you're buzzing on at some point. Secondly, you have to remember the clue like today on the day that you're buzzing on it. And third of all, you actually have to like buzz on it. And like if there's a buzzer race, you know, you need to win the buzzer race. You know, when you buzz, you need to say the correct words. You don't want to screw up a syllable and get nagged or something like that. So really, I think of all improvement as, you know, based on improving in one of these three areas. I like to think of it as finding clues, learning clues, and then buzzing on clues. I'm not going to talk much about buzzing on clues because I'm actually like pretty bad at it. I have bad buzzer speed. I eat horrible things the days of tournament, so I'm sleepy. Like, and then I drink way too much caffeine, and it's like bad. I don't know why I do it. I need to fix that. But I think like when we get to the panel, I'm sure people will have, especially coaches, will have good ideas on like what to eat, how much to sleep, you know, all that sort of good things, how to win buzzer races. You probably don't want to listen to me on that issue. But the two things I think that have given me the competitive advantage is like encountering, finding more clues and then learning them well. Because, you know, if you do enough of that, then it doesn't matter how slow you are on the buzzer. You're just going to beat them by a clue and then like they can't beat you. So just do that instead. The way I've encountered, finding clues, I think that's the first step because, you know, if you never hear the clue, then you're never going to be able to get it. So there's a bunch of ways you can find new clues. You can start, obviously the way that almost everyone does in, you know, Quiz Bowl is through packets. I think that's how everyone starts, certainly when you want to branch out for the canon. So you have the packet-based approach. You have some sort of, like, real knowledge approach. Like, right, you can read a book, and then if the book's tossed up and you remember the clues you read in the book, you're going to, you know, that's how you found those clues. You know, and then there's, like, the third way I think is really you can sort of research in-depth on a topic without getting, like, real knowledge on it. So, you know, if I really want to know, like, so Chinua Achebe is going to be my example that I keep going back to in this talk. So if I really want to know things about Things Fall Apart and I just like I'm like, you know, I am not feeling like reading Things Fall Apart, there's a bunch of other ways I can learn a lot of clues about Things Fall Apart. You know, I can go to Spark Notes. I can, you know, instead of just reading a packet, I can like use one of those packet searching tools online, of which there are now like 50 redundant ones. I think Pace recommends Quinterest. We sponsor that, so use that. But anyway, right, like you can go and see every toss up on Things Fall Apart on the like archives in whatever fashion you want, and then just learn every clue that's ever come up for Things Fall Apart, and then like read some articles and reviews on Things Fall Apart, and then be like better than almost everyone at Things Fall Apart. Certainly you'll beat everyone who hasn't ever read the book, which is a lot of people, although a lot of people have read Things Fall Apart, so maybe you should actually read it. But so those are really the three ways. And the way I like to do this is I like to mix up the three ways. When I was in high school, I got lucky because my high school sort of left their printers unguarded, and I could just print out obscene amounts of packets, and, like, they didn't do anything to me. And then they started doing things to people the year after I left, but I was gone, so it didn't matter. And what I did was, sorry anyone from Ladue who's listening to this, I would just, like, every morning I would go to the library, I would print out a couple of packets, I would, you know, it was senior year, you know, so I wasn't paying too much attention in classes. So, I like, when the teacher was lecturing, I'd be, like, you know, like, have the packet out under the desk and be reading through and be, like, ah, like, that's an important clue. And then I'd take out my pen and I'd circle it, you know, and I'd mark where I buzzed or would have buzzed. And then I'd hand it to, like, you know, Ben Zhang was in my class, who was on my team, so I'd hand the packet to him and I'd tell him to mark where he buzzed, you know. And we'd just do this all day, like, all year. And then I'd take the packets home and, I'd have maybe, like, 50 pages of just, like, clues. And some of them would be circled and they'd be these things that I wanted to learn about. And, So just a brief, you know, spoiler alert. The way I memorize things is through flashcards. That's the way my mind works. And I found that effective. I know a lot of other people don't find it effective, but I'm going to be talking about that all that later. But the point is, when I, like, found these clues, you know, the temptation is very strong to just, oh, I've got this clue on paper. I can just flashcard it. Boom. Okonkwo is the protagonist of Things Fall Apart. Let's call it a day. That's a thing I didn't know about Things Fall Apart. All right, next toss-up. Move on. That is a way to learn things. I don't think that's the most efficient way to learn things. What I did was I would take these toss-ups, and there'd be a lot of clues. And, you know, depending on the level, you really want to be reading something where there's a lot of clues you don't know. If all you're doing is reading, like, high school sets where you know every clue in it but the lead-in, that's a waste of your time because in all this time you're reading one toss-up, you only get one clue out of it. You want to be reading something that's, like, challenging. You want to be reading something that, like, you're like, wow, this is way too hard for me. I know when I was in high school, I was, like, reading hard college stuff, and the point wasn't that I was, like, competent at it. Like, I could answer things by the end. You don't want to be reading something where you can't ever answer any of the questions, but it was good. I knew, like, the clue before for 10 points, and then I knew the giveaway. And then that meant there was, like, 6 lines of, like, excellently researched, well-written clues that I could just take and learn. And I think that's much more efficient than high school stuff. Certainly when you're, like, good enough that you're, like, you know, high school stuff is getting easy. So, anyway, so you find these clues, and then in addition to, like, having these clues on paper, you also have the magic of the internet now, and you can, like, look up all these clues. So definitely the first thing I always wanted to do was I wanted to look up every clue, make sure it was unique, see what else the clue could apply to, I was a literature specialist in high school. That was my, like, bread and butter. So it wasn't as much of a problem for literature because, you know, there's a very nice, like, tree of things, right? Like, a clue applies to a character, and that character is in a novel, and that novel is by an author. And you're never going to have weird things where, like, one clue could apply to two things unless, like, it's an incident that happens in multiple works. But, you know, that isn't the case in, like, history or science or whatever. So you want to be sure that, like, sometimes a clue could apply to a country, sometimes a clue could apply to a leader, sometimes, you know, like, it could apply to two leaders, and you have to figure out which one it is. So you want to go through and not just blindly, like, associate these words with each person. You want to go through and see, like, what the substance of the clue is, what's actually going on, you know, and then learn it. And then the way I organized these clues was I just made enormous lists. I just had, like, lists of answer lines and then, like, bullet points under the list with, like, sub-answer lines. So, you know, I had, like, a 100-plus page list of authors, and then each author had, like, a bullet point, you know, number of bullet points with their works, and then under each bullet point was a number of clues for each work that was important. Yeah, I don't know. You have to figure out what clues you want to find and include on this list, because if you make these lists too big, you know, you're never going to memorize all of them. You're just going to have these clues that you don't know. If you make these lists too small, then someone's going to have a bigger list that they know all of, and they're going to beat you. So it's sort of finding this golden mean. A good way to get a set, you know, a handle on that is to write a lot of questions, read a lot of questions, sort of get a good, once you, like, so in high school, I, like, edited a bunch of tournaments. Ledoux put out a tournament every year called List. So I got, like, a really good handle on, like, what sort of clues work in toss-ups, what sort of clues, like, do I want to put on my list, what are worth remembering. Because when you're researching, when you're leaving the packets, you've got this big Wikipedia article on, like, things fall apart, and you have to think, like, okay, you know, I'm going to NSC, like, next month, you know, some lazy editor is definitely starting on Wikipedia to read about things fall apart, like, what clues is he or she going to take and, like, contemplate including, you know, what clues do I want to, because if you read through Wikipedia, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't good clues, there's a lot of things that aren't going to get in. There's a lot of things that are going to take too long to describe in a toss-up uniquely. These are the sort of things you want to be like, eh, I don't care about, you know? Like, it's not worth my time remembering. Because you have a finite amount of time, so you really want to maximize the amount of clues you can learn per minute. And then, like, you know, adjust mathematically for, like, how often the clue comes up, right? Like, if it takes you a lot of time to memorize a clue that comes up, like, at every tournament, that's a good investment of your time because you're going to be buzzing on that a lot per time spent. But if you memorize, like, 10 clues from, like, you know, Chinua Achebe's, like, 10th most famous story, that's stupid, right? Like, just learn the protagonist's name, learn what happens. You know, if it sounds like an interesting story, read it for your own, like, intellectual, you know, enjoyment. But, you know, don't overdo everything. You know, sort of focus on the things that you have the time to focus on. Anyway, so what was nice about these lists is they sort of enabled me to see what clues I had already found. Then when I'm going through a packet and I've, you know, I come across a new clue, I'm like, oh, that's like an incident from Things Fall Apart that I don't remember. Then I go and I can, like, you know, go to my literature list, control F, like Achebe. Oh, like, I already have that clue on there. What does that mean? That means I screwed up somewhere in step number two, the memorization. And, you know, it's no use having all these clues on your, like, lists on your computer or however you do it if they aren't in your head where you can buzz on them. Because you can't, like, pull out this literature list and then control F in the middle of a game. The Myri's going to be like, what are you doing, dude? Like, not okay. So the way I always did it was flashcards. I'm a big fan of, like, spaced repetition softwares. Like, I use Mnemosyne. A lot of people like Anki a lot. These are things that are good for me because I, you know, they sort of resemble what happens in a Quiz Bowl game. You know, you have to, you see these words and then you have to, like, remember what that, you know, it simulates the process. You know, you've got a discrete clue and you have to figure out what it's referring to. And, you know, I like it because it adds structure to my schedule. You know, I'm just like, okay, like, the first half hour of my Quiz Bowl study session, I'm going to do my, like, daily dose of cards. A lot of people I know hate cards. If that's the case, you should figure out how you memorize best and, like, do that. I probably, the panel will have good tips on that, you know, front. I don't really do anything besides flashcards to, like, keep stuff in my head. So I can't really speak to that. Let's see. One thing I want to note is that you shouldn't think of the flashcards as, like, your only source of knowledge. I do put every clue on a flashcard, but the point is not that I cease to remember everything else. It's that the clue sort of triggers my memory of what's going on. So, like, I've read Things Fall Apart. So when I see a Things Fall Apart card, my knowledge of Things Fall Apart is not just, you know, the lump sum of everything I put on a flashcard. It's that every time I see, like, one of my Things Fall Apart flashcards, it reminds me of that part of the novel. It keeps it fresh in my head. It makes it so I can buzz on other things and, like, related scenes that I didn't card. And I think a lot of the time where high schoolers go awry in this process is they just sort of flashcard things. They're like, ah, like, I can do word association. I can just always buzz on Okonkwo, like, and I'm always going to beat everyone in my region. And that's, like, true, you know, because when you're playing the IS set, they're never going to toss up anything but, like, Things Fall Apart or Achebe. But, like, you have to be careful that all your flashcards are unique and they point to something good. You can't just sort of memorize, like, oh, like, I don't know, who's someone in No Longer to Ease? Obi Okonkwo, right? You can't just be like, Obi equals, like, Chinua Achebe, right? Because, like, sure, on an IS set, every time you hear Obi, it's going to be, like, Chinua Achebe. They're never going to toss up No Longer at Ease. But then, like, you know, you're at, like, you know, HSNCT, and they say Obi, you know, takes bribes. And you're like, ah, like, I know that. That's my Chinua Achebe. Wait, what novel is it? Oh, it's Chinua Achebe. It must be Things Fall Apart. What? -5. How can you do this to me? I memorized that clue. And, like, you know, that's going to happen if you are not smart about how you do your flashcards. So that's important. So, like I said, I try to make my flashcards as specific as possible. I don't really want to talk too much about flashcarding unless people want me to talk more about flashcarding, so you can ask me about that. But the general idea of what I do when I'm carding is I sort of just, like, have a, like, one sentence summary of, like, what I want, like, you know, like a question, like, what novel is Okonkwo the protagonist of, as opposed to just Okonkwo Things Fall Apart. That way I can be on top of, you know, I can know everything. And then, like, for something like history, you can be like, what leader did such and such happen under, you know, and then have another card, like, what country did so-and-so leader rule? And then you sort of have this, like, big web in your head. And, you know, it's annoying on, like, NAQT questions where you don't have as much time to trace through that web, but you can be like, oh, that's, like, a Salazar clue, and, like, Salazar ruled Portugal, so, you know, Portugal, yay. Or, like, Carnation Revolution. You know, you just go along the web as you need to. Yeah, so that's sort of how I think about studying. You know, find clues, remember the clues, and then buzz on the clues. You know, sort of, and then take a big, you know, step back. Before you do anything, sort of think, how is this helping me study? Is this the most efficient way I could be studying? Are these clues that I think are going to come up at some point in the future? Are these clues that are unique and memorable? Are these clues that are going to be used in a toss-up? You know, yeah, I think that's about it. You know, just sort of hit those three areas, always be improving, always be, like, working efficiently and hard. So that's what I got.
Thank you, Max. I'm actually going to piggyback on something he said, at least just for pharmacy school. I'm a big note card guy in general, but I've kind of hit the point where note cards aren't cutting it because it's just too multidimensional. Just by chance, I found this app called Simple Mind for my iPad, which allows you to make kind of, like, thought maps, I guess is the best way to put it. I'm holding up an example right now. You just get to draw these circles and connect concepts, and it kind of gives you a visual way to go through a path to be like, oh, okay, that's what this medication is for, and that's why I shouldn't give it to this person unless I want to murder them, which, of course, I don't want to do that. If you're in the medical professional, try to keep people alive. What's that? It's called Simple Mind. It's all one word, and it's like six, maybe $5, something like that. And I think there's a desktop version as well, though I haven't tried that. I like it a lot myself for that purpose. Anyways, do we have any questions just in general for the panel, for Max, for Julie, Eric, Jacob?
Thanks, Fred. Max, I was just wanting you to talk a little bit about the transition from going to being an all-right player to, like, a regionally good player. I think that's something that could prove useful for the panel.
Okay. I mean, pretty briefly, I'm sure everyone had different paths to this, but my freshman year, my Quiz Bowl team was just, you know, like, we didn't actually do anything. Hilariously, I was recruited onto my team to just do the computational math questions at, like, Missouri State Contest, and then I, like, realized I actually knew other things. And then sort of just after my freshman year, I just got into it, and, like, I think Charlie D's linked me to, like, quizbowlpackets.com, and I just went through and, like, read a lot of packets until I got a grasp of the canon. I didn't really start, like, hardcore flashcarding or anything. I just sort of read through the packets. I, like, looked up clues that I didn't know. I looked up things that sounded interesting to me. And, you know, I'm a really, really competitive person. So, like, you know, it provided the impetus to learn things because I really wanted to be the best on my team, best in the state, you know, certainly best in the area. So I just, like, went through, just read stuff, remembered stuff, you know, reinforced stuff. I don't know if other people want to talk about their similar transitions.
Sure. Yeah, so I kind of peaked at that pretty good stage and didn't go on to the next stage like Max did. But, yeah, basically what it took for me was just staying around Quiz Bowl a lot and just playing a lot of Quiz Bowl. I didn't really – don't follow my advice unless you want to peak at being okay. But what I did after I joined the team freshman year, I just, like, went to practice twice a week, every single week for, like, 2 years. And then my junior year, I was like, oh, wait, I've heard, like, a whole lot of packets and have an extremely good memory, so I kind of remember things now. So, yeah, basically to do that, I think the most important thing is to just be exposed to a lot of Quiz Bowl, whether you want to take the slow road and just go to practice and play a couple tournaments, or the quick road and read things on your own.
I don't think I'm going to really add anything to that Max and Joe haven't said, but for me to make that leap from, like, seventh blessed player, and that's pushing it, on my college team as a freshman or sophomore, to second best player on my college team was mostly just accretion from packets. I'm not going to lie. It's, you know, it's, there's a lot of material out there. And, you know, if you're the kind of person who's, like, you know, you're here at Pace NSC, so you're clearly, like, interested in trivia and knowing things. Like, you will read packets, you will absorb the things that are interesting to you, and, like, just for fun, you know, even if you don't like set up a sort of studying regimen like Max did for himself, if you just read about the things that you read in packets that are interesting to you, you will get better, and you will certainly at least get to sort of the middling stage that Max and Joe outlined.
Just have a quick for the coaches. If you have players who are graduating from high school and they have flashcards and they don't plan to play in college, take their flashcards at the picnic at the end of the year. Have a ceremony. They will have someone who's inheriting their part of the canon. Make it a big deal. Here is my box of flashcards. You don't have to start from go. Siblings. I've had a lot of success with siblings, especially pairs of sisters. If you know, the sisters guard their flashcards very closely and pass them, you know, down. And again, they, you know, get bigger and bigger boxes for the flashcards, as well as the whole notebook thing. I mean, I love flashcards. Oh, yeah, you have the ceremony.
We
too.
Do the exact same
thing. All right. Any other questions? Floor is completely open, guys. Anything in the world? All right. Just to repeat the question real quick, it's how to handle misspeaks, how to reduce those, how to reduce whenever someone buzzes on a question. They know the answer, but they just spit out the wrong thing. Eric's got the mic.
And just for the sake of the recording, I'm Eric Mukherjee. I go to Penn. I edited NSC in 2012 and 2013, and that's pretty much my biggest claim to fame as far as high school is concerned. I actually do misspeak a lot, and I've learned that sort of my misspeaks are like switching like two letters or two syllables around. Like, for example, a common answer in harder tournaments that hopefully will never come up in high school is a person named Leslie Fiedler, but I would always say Leslie Fielder. And this actually cost us points against Yale once, and that's a long story. But so what I learned is the reason that this was happening to me is I was reading about – oh, speaking of Yale, there's Jacob Reed right there. So the reason this was happening to me is because I was only reading these things silently to myself, and I would, you know, read very quickly through, like, a lot of packets, and – when I would do that, I would actually, like, I actually absorbed the person's name in this case as Leslie Fielder, and I always remembered it that way. And so the thing that sort of helped me was just to, for, like, more complicated names especially, to just, like, slow down and actually pronounce it out to myself. Like, okay, well, here's a better answer that comes up in, like, harder high school tournaments. Like, the person whose death started the Rwandan genocide is Juvenal Habyarimana. Like, this is a very long name, and I'd always screw up the syllables until I literally, like, sat down and said it to myself, like, several times. And I think that's personally what helped me get over that. But.
Yeah, I know this is kind of a related thing with that tip-of-the-tongue syndrome where, like, you know the answer. Oh, yeah, it's totally Achebe. You buzz in. Oh, it's that Nigerian guy who wrote Things Fall Apart, you know, the one who was just in my head. So, like, I don't know if you guys watched that game against the computer at HSNCT last weekend, but the computer always had in its head the probability bars. So presumably most of you, when you're playing, you kind of have that a little bit in your head. Like, maybe you hear a question with a bunch of Nigerian names on an IS set, and you're thinking, okay, it's probably Achebe, but maybe this question writer is crazy and it's on Soyinka instead. Just write Achebe down on your paper. And then if you hear a clue that makes you know, oh, like, Achebe would never write about something like that, just cross it out, and then now you're thinking the most likely answer is Soyinka. Write down Soyinka on your paper. And then that way when you buzz in, just you can just read what you wrote. It's right there. It's right in front of you. You know it. You know how to say that.
Well, for me, in 10th grade, once I started getting good, I once sat in my room and said, like, Kachushika Hokusai, like, 100 times in a row until I got it right. I've never messed that up again. More pragmatically, since I do the flashcards a lot, when I'm not worried about my roommate thinking I'm really weird, I just say the answers out loud when I do them. And then I get tons of practice saying it. Obviously, you know, having practice a lot means you have to say, like, words a lot. Reading questions out loud means that you, like, have to say lots of names out loud. So it's good to staff tournaments. It's good to go to practice regularly. All these things help with not flubbing as much.
And I think that what y'all said is all of those are awesome. One thing another way that sometimes we'll misspeak is when a student will speak too quickly. They'll get excited about something and buzz in and shout something out. I always encourage my kids, take a breath before you speak. Always wait to be recognized is what I'd tell even though it's not necessary, that gives you that moment to gather your thoughts and think and speak clearly. Because a lot of times we'll get excited. We'll hear, oh, I know that. And then you'll say something just out, you know, and as soon as you say, take a breath, speak slowly, speak clearly. That's my advice on that. But doesn't really speak to what y'all were saying, which is specifically mispronouncing the word. But anyway.
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback on that. I think that's really good advice. Another thing that allows you to do that people don't talk about enough is that it sort of lets you control the pace of the game. And I feel like, you know, especially in the NUKT format where it's timed, there's just times where I know my team will go, like, faster and faster and faster, and then eventually it just gets so quick that we just get too aggressive, and we start negging when we shouldn't, and just bad things happen. And some, you know, in the NAQT format, it's not necessarily a bad idea to, you know, call the timeout if that's happening to you, if you don't really need the timeout otherwise. But for something like the PACE or, like, HSFQ-type formats, I'll often just say, like, okay, we're going to, like, slow down on this bonus, like, just listen to the whole bonus part, like, wait a few seconds before we answer, you know, buzz in on the toss-up, but, like, wait a few seconds before you say the toss-up, and that sort of, like, reins everybody in, especially if you're, like, the captain on your team, like, it's your job to sort of set the pace and make sure that people aren't, like, going off like runaway horses, you know, this is very important.
Quickly, Sam. same deal, exactly. The kids, especially in Science Bowl, when you're not allowed to write things down ahead of time, but as soon as you're allowed to write things down, you write, buzz, breathe, think, speak.
I mean, and there's like 5 seconds in ACF format for a reason. You know, you got those 5 seconds. Use them if you need to. Any other questions? Right there?
So in terms of, like, building a team rather than just a player, I've gotten, like, tips from a lot of people in terms of how we should organize study habits. Like, should we have a team of generalists or a team of specialists in topics? So how would you guys recommend that? Like, what are the pros and cons of specializations versus generalizations? And which generally tend to do better?
I mean, so the not helpful answer is that it's going to depend a ton on your team, who's on your team, how much they're putting in. So, like, when I made the big leap my sophomore year, no one else on my team really, like, cared too much about quiz bowl. Like, they'd come to tournaments, they'd play with me, they knew a few things, but, you know, I sort of had to do everything on my own. And then I had the good fortune of, you know, a couple people joined the team, a couple people got more interested who really wanted to buckle down and study. So we sort of morphed into that, like, really good generalist, but with a bunch of good specialists next to them mold that works out pretty well. But, you know, it depends a lot on your team. If you got four people who are all working really equally, then you can do the specialist approach. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, just speaking from the coach's perspective on that, I mentioned earlier how important I think it is that we as coaches teach accountability and teach responsibility to our students. Part of that is you have a role on this team, you have a responsibility, and whether that role is as broad as literature or as specific as, you know, Italian opera, you have a responsibility to those other people you're playing with to learn those things. I think that specialization, to answer your question, is ultimately going to, in the long run, get you more questions, win you more games, if you have four people that specialize. But, you know, beyond the winning and the losing, I think that as coaches, if we can help our students specialize, it gives them that responsibility, gives them that role. If you're a generalist and there's someone else on your team that's also a generalist that's just better than you, you're not going to get a lot of questions. But I had a lot of kids over the years where I knew, hey, listen, this student is not going to get seven toss-ups in a game, but if he can be awesome at, and I'll say opera again as an example, whatever it is, he has something to contribute. And I think that that's something that's really, really important. Again, that's from a coach's perspective, not as much a player's perspective. So.
From the perspective of someone who doesn't like being told what to do, you should build your team the way your team members want to themselves to be built. Like, if you have a guy walk in on day one and you're like, okay, dude, you're a fine arts specialist. And he's like, what? Like, to me, the classics are Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. Like, doesn't do it. Like that's not going to work out. That person's probably either going to be bad or quit the team. So if you walk into a team, if you have a guy on your team who walks in and is like, hey, I really like science, I have a 105% in AP physics or whatever, then even if you technically already have a science specialist, you should still probably encourage that person to study science, because you're not going to win anything by forcing them to study something that they aren't interested in just to meet some theoretical ideal distribution of knowledge among your teammates.
So I kind of have a two-part answer to this, and that's, first, I don't really see that big of a distinction between generalists and specialists. Like, even to this day, I still consider myself a specialist. Like, pretty much everybody disagrees with me on this for some reason. But I think you should more think about it like any four given people on a team are going to have very different interests. Like, you're not going to have four people who are all interested in the same, like, 1-1 of a distribution. Like, that's just, like, the odds of that are, like, astronomically small. So just sort of touching on the theme of accountability, the way I like to think of it is I like to think of it as sort of taking ownership of, like, the 1-1 or 2-2 of the distribution that I really like, and I want to, you know, be able to beat as many people as I can to these, like, two questions. And when I first started, I considered it a successful game if I was getting, like, just, like, 10, 20 points per game. But if those 10, 20 points were in my categories and they were helping us win, like, that's what I needed to do, like, as somebody who was just starting out. And then after that, like, I sort of expanded out and tried to learn things outside of those categories, if only because even if you have, for example, a literature specialist on your team, and, like, I'm not a literature person, like, at all. I'm very bad at literature. But there will be instances, you know, even in, you know, the finals of ICT, where a literature question will go to the clue that everybody knows, and you might be the fastest one in, and you'll have just, you know, gotten that question, and your buzz is just as good as your literature specialist buzz in that case, and that's, you know, that's good enough. That's
always have an opinion here. And I don't do the statistical amazing stuff that you guys do. It seemed to me for years I had teams that were three very good players who knew a lot of things and had specialties, and one real wild-ass critter that could pull God knows what out of somewhere. And I think you guys are talking about the same thing in a kind of a weird way. And most of you know the names of my weird guys over the years.
One thing I want to pitch in on that from my own experience, I helped Parkersburg High School run practices for a couple years when they had Nick Brumfield, who was pretty good and probably could have made an impact in nationals if the coach actually took him to anything but Chip. But the thing with him was that his teammates just really didn't care. So to get back to the original question, which is what do you do to try to get your team, the Panglossian perfection of the specialists is very hard to achieve. I mean, it's easy to say, well, it'd be great if everyone got every question in every category, and they all knew their one specific category, and then we win all the games. That'd be wonderful, except it's not real. It's, you know, not even video game Quiz Bowl. It's just like, I'm making crap up Quiz Bowl. What I think that the best thing you can do to find out, like, what would work for your team is to actually talk to your teammates and have a conversation about, okay, what are we doing here? What do we want to do? What do you want to do? Will you actually learn category X so that we can get those questions and then win the games we need to against the teams that currently are better than us, but once you learn it, won't be? That's just what I thought would have worked out better in that situation. It would have really helped them take another step forward. A question in the back?
Yeah, this is not related, whatever.
Sure. Let me try to capture that just for the recording. So the question is, if you're in a situation where you're ready to buzz in a question and you think you know the answer, but you're not 100% sure on it, and you're thinking to yourself, is it actually this guy that I'm thinking of, or is it someone else? How do you make the decision to buzz it and go with what your gut answer is? Is that correct, you think?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I mean, this is very much a situation and player-dependent thing, but for me, it's so there's sort of two things I'm going to take into account, and that's, like, how my aggression is doing, like, that particular tournament. Like, hopefully this is, like, this sort of nail-biter situation's happening later in the day, so you sort of have a feel for the set, sort of have a feel for how you're playing that particular day. Like, if your sort of gambles have been paying off, like, throughout the day, you know, I let myself get a little more unhinged. You know, if I'm sort of negging, if I'm negging more than I would like, I'll probably wait an extra clue. The other thing is to sort of know your opponents as well as you can. If you're playing, you know, if you're like a literature specialist playing against another very good literature specialist, you know, it may behoove you to be just a little bit more aggressive than you would be against like, say, a good team that doesn't have, you know, as good of a literature specialist. But I think the more specific question you're asking is sort of the mental process of deciding, like when you should buzz in. And I think that's actually like a very difficult thing to know. But one thing you can do to train is, if you have the player with sort of the opposite problem where, like, they know the answer, and like they're just not buzzing in. Like something that actually a friend of mine and Max's likes to do is, like, he's very good at telling, you know, in a practice situation when we know what's happening. Like, he will just literally reach over and hit the buzzer and then force us to say whatever's on our minds. And that's actually something I've started doing with the undergraduates on my team. And it actually works pretty well in, you know, if you do it over a longer period of time. And it sort of builds confidence that, you know, they know the answer. So it sort of depends, like, it depends a lot, like, which direction you're coming from. Like, if you're being too aggressive, like, you know, pulling back is not that difficult of a thing to do, but the opposite thing is also a problem, and it's important to sort of just, you know, practice a lot and understand how you're playing that particular day and your opponents, and to weigh these things as much as you can. At least that's how I like to approach it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Eric that it's a lot situational. I think it's different in high school than in college, because in college you sort of know who everyone is, you know what everyone's specialty is. you know whether the matchup in that category is favorable for you or for them, you know, because there's like much fewer college teams. You know, at a high school national, odds are the team you're playing, you don't really know too much about them besides like vaguely how good they are. But what you do know a lot about is your own team. So you can sort of think, like, the way I always do it is, you know, so in college I have one of the best music players in the country on my team. So if I like think I know the answer to a music toss up, but I'm not 100% sure, I'm not going anywhere near my buzzer, cause you will like kill me. But like, you know, I'm like sort of our go-to like science guy, especially on like some subcategories of science, like math. So if like a lot of the time it's in a situation where like, if I don't know it, no one on the team's going to know it. So, you know, then what I'm doing is I'm weighing in, you know, is there a chance that like, it's actually something I'm going to get later, you know, how good am I in an absolute sense? Like, do I think this next clue is going to benefit me more than it's going to benefit my opponent is really the calculus that's always going on in your head. Like, so if you're really, really good at a category, like odds are like, you know, that next clue, especially if it's early in the toss up, and especially if it's like tournaments with longer questions like NSC or NASAT, where you've got like 8 lines of like thick description going on there, like, next clue is probably going to be something that you're more likely to know than they are. But if you're playing like a top team and, you know, you realize, wait, none of us know literature and I have an inkling on literature and I hear this guy's really good at literature, then maybe you should take the plunge. You know, it's very situational.
Yeah, in practice, you can try to practice for that moment by just stopping the question and everybody writes down the answer. At this point in the question, write down your answer. Or at this point, you know, just you're slowing down the question, somebody has to buzz, and whatever you can do to get through that moment. So you as an individual player, you know, you've got a whole room full of kids, trying to teach a whole room full of kids how they know to know, how they know when they know, when the tingle hits that they can't resist. You know, they got to know they're going to have the tingle and buzz at that second, and then think about what the answer might be.
Just one more thing I forgot, is that after you've been playing a really long time, you can sort of like, especially when the question gets late and you've seen like a million questions on a toss up, you know what the last like, you know, the last 3 clues are going to come from this like subset of 6 possible clues. So if it's really an answer on X, then I know the next clue is going to be like, there's going to be one of these 3 words in it and I can buzz on the first syllable of that word or like the first name of this guy that I know is going to get mentioned.
All right. Anyone else? Okay, question?
Hi. My team and I are pretty new to pace. We're more used to the NAQT-style questions. So could you highlight some of the primary differences between sort of the NAQT-style and the pace format?
All right, so the question is, we have someone who's new to pace and more used to NAQT, so they're wondering what really are the differences between pace as compared with NAQT.
So obviously one of the main functional differences between pace and NAQT is that here your bonuses bounce back at basically every other tournament except for some weird local ones. They will not. So at tournaments where bonuses do not bounce back, please, like, confer out loud with your teammates. Like, there's nothing more frustrating than being a moderator and watching a team, a lot of new teams do this, come into, like, an NAQT tournament where bonuses don't bounce back, and they get a toss-up and they get a bonus, and they're like, hey, is it this? I think it might be this. And then there's, like, you know, two people, like, and they're sitting at the opposite ends of the table, and they just are not communicating at all. Like, if the bonuses don't bounce back, hey, dude, is it this? I don't know. I think it was this. Oh, that makes sense. Let's go with that. Just, yeah.
I mean, in a very practical sense, also, the distributions are different. You know, there's a lot more fine arts, a lot more, you know, a lot less geography, current events, trash in, yeah, NSC. Yeah. I personally prefer NSC a lot. I don't know. The questions are, in general, longer. Yeah, I don't know. In terms of stylistic stuff, I mean, you know, if this is your first NSC, get ready to take the plunge. Like, you'll feel out the set as you go. I mean, in general, you want to play mostly similar ways, though. Because, I mean, they aren't too different in how, like, the bell curve or the difficulty. Sometimes there's a really hard answer. Sometimes there's an easy answer. You know, just play it like you play Quiz Bowl.
The corollary to my statement that I forgot to say was that at pace or other tournaments with bounce backs, you should not holler out the answers you're thinking of. I forgot to explicitly state that. Don't tomorrow, don't go say, I think it's this, dude.
Oh, and don't nag an academic toss-up with a trash answer at NSC, where there's no trash.
The lack of timing versus on NAQT versus pace.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say that as a player who does this a lot, you have a better shot of buzzing in where you know the answer and then coming up with it in the 5 seconds. Whereas when I'm playing NAQT, I don't buzz unless I am very sure I'm about to know the answer. Whereas with this, I can say, okay, I know that clue. I can buzz in. I can take my 4 seconds to come up with it and then still reliably come up with it. If that's the way you like to play, that's fine. Some people will neg a lot of questions when they do that. So, you know, but that's a strategy that's available to you. The way you use time should be a little different. The time's a lot more expansive in this format, though, because as Coach Green said.
Okay. Question? Okay. Okay, so the question is, should playing a team that is better than you affect your play style?
I think Mike wants to go. My answer would be no. This isn't a game that... See, people think you're playing Quiz Bowl against another team, but it's actually a lot closer to something like golf. Like, you're playing against the course. Okay, you can't play better. You can't get stuff you didn't otherwise know. You shouldn't fool around. But to the extent you can, you should try to tune out everything else, focus on the question. When you know the question, get it. I find that almost invariably when a team is like, oh, we need to play like better against this team, they don't play as well as they could. They're too tight. They don't come up with answers they otherwise could. You want to stay focused and relaxed and play against the questions. And if you manage to beat a team you shouldn't beat, hey, good for you. I mean, you're good enough to have beaten them. That's all. I don't think so, not in general. Like, if you want to amp up your risk appetite against a harder team, that's not a horrible strategy, but I think people are bad at estimating what other people are going to get and where. So I think basically your first strategy should be to play within yourself.
Especially if you don't know that other team a lot, like you may get nationals. Right. I just broke my own rule. You may not know that team very well at Nationals. So if that's the case, you know, you probably don't know what they actually do know. I mean, you may have heard on the boards that this guy is good at history, but you don't know if he actually knows Chinese history or whatever. And, you know, so if you play them a lot and you know them well and you happen to be friends with them, you know, exploit that friendship, you know. Draw blood. Just be like, okay, so I know this guy doesn't know anything about Mao. We're just going to wait a little bit more until I'm sure it is actually Mao Zedong or, you know, whatever. So just as one example. Eric?
So I think it's interesting that you bring that up. If you do know the other team, this is the only instance I would say play differently, is if you know the other team, like if you're friends with them and you're in sort of a high-pressure situation, I think it's fine, like, to take a few risks. There's this great post by Matt Bollinger on the boards about a game he played at ICT where it was question 24 and he was within like 10 points of the other team. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was an art toss up, and he was thinking in his head like, okay, this is the last question. Like, I'm like 60-70% sure that it's this person, like, just from context clues. Like, I don't even know these specific clues, but just from context, I'm pretty sure this is the only person it could be. He said, if I sit on this question and I lose this question, like, I'll have lost this tournament. But if I pull the trigger and at least, like, give it, like, a decent shot, then I'll have said, like, I've at least done my best. And he pulled the trigger and he got the question and he ended up winning the tournament. So I think in certain situations it makes sense, but those situations are few and far between, and especially if you're sort of a team that's like just starting out, that this is not something you necessarily need to take into account. Like, focus more on learning clues.
Yeah, to kind of go along with what Fred said, so Eric, myself, and Max all get a decent amount of physics questions. So let's say that my team is playing Eric or Max's team, and their teams are both normally better than mine, so we're trying to spring an upset. And so I'm saying I'm playing Eric, and the physics question comes up. Then I know Eric is probably not going to neg the physics question. He doesn't do that too often. So I'm going to be pretty aggressive, and I'm going to buzz in even when I'm not as confident as I normally am. But when I play Max, I know Max loves to neg physics questions. I know. There's one year where I'm pretty sure we played his team six times, and in five of those games, he negged the physics question.
The other time.
And I got it the other five times, so I didn't buzz in before him in any of those six games, and it worked out pretty well. We didn't win, but for that question. But that strategy only works if you have a very high amount of knowledge about your opponents. And so normally, unless you're very sure it's what you want to do, it's very easy to overthink it and get caught up in that instead of just playing the game.
I mean, just real quick, the other thing that, like, is going to happen is if you are going to upset them, it's probably going to be a really close game, so you don't want to be flubbing bonus parts. So just, like, buckle down and play really smart on everything that you, like, can control completely.
Yeah, I would echo that advice. Like, just play smart. Play the best game you can and don't try to play better than that, because you're gonna mess up if you do that. This is a game where you can fall on your face very easily by trying to go outside yourself. The other thing I was going to add was when Eric was describing the way Matt was thinking about that question, the thing that stuck out to me was he was 70% sure. If I had a 70% shot on a question on a toss-up to win, like, an ICT, I would already have buzzed. That's what makes a good player, is he's saying, I'm 70% sure this is a good risk because I win 70% of the time. I'm going with that, okay? Because I win or lose, and 70% of the time I win. But the situation you described where it was like you're one-third sure, you lose on average in that scenario. You want to be a little more careful than that. I don't know. I find people, like, outthink themselves. Like, if you're thinking about, like, oh, how do I play the game or whatever, you're not playing at your peak. You need to process the questions. You need to get the questions, and you need to not really worry about anything else. If you get more points, you win. Very simple game.
Okay. We got about 6 minutes left per what I had scheduled. Anyone have any other questions? Okay.
Yes, I do. This is a good strategic point. If you chart times you do this, at least for me,
when I go in and I have a really good answer in mind, I only ever want to go away from that first answer I had when I'm suddenly very sure it's wrong for, like, a good reason. Like, oh, I misheard something earlier, so it can't be what I thought it was. Because most of the time when I change from the answer I was going with to a new answer, it's wrong. It's not even necessarily that my first answer was right. Okay, maybe my first answer was wrong, but my second answer is almost always wrong. Again, the only exception is if it's like, oh, in retrospect, it absolutely can't be this. I'm guessing someone from the 13th century and you just told me this was the 12th century. I should change my answer at that point. But unless you have some factual reason like that, your first answer is much more likely to be right. That's just a numerical fact. That's for me. I haven't done that for other players. I'm much more familiar with my own play than anyone else's. But I would advise you to at least look at that. Are you the kind of player that buzzes in, has that moment of existential terror, changes your answer because you're afraid, and then you've changed to a wrong answer, and then you feel even worse? Or are you like me where, okay, like my first answer was right, I should have gone with that, and I'm dumb for changing it, and I did this again. Unfortunately, knowing this, I still make the same mistake over and over again. So don't be like me. Figure out which way you are. I think if you look at it, you'll probably find you're like me and tend to go with your first answer. Your instincts are, if you're good at this game, your instincts are pretty good, right? Like, you know, you can come up with things where people are like, how did you do that? You have so little information and you got to something so specific, but that's the nature of this game. So trust that, all else equal, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with what you just said. I've always found that, you know, even if you're, like, thinking back over the earlier clues and you're like, wait, that can't be right, it's, like, also very possible that the moderator flubbed something or you misheard and, like, you know, they said a year wrong when it should have been a year that, like, makes it right. So, like, if you've already buzzed in, then there's a good reason. The only time I ever change is if, like, the word the moderator is saying when, like, I'm buzzing is, like, something that's, like, incorrect, like a new title. Or, like, I'm like, wait, that clue applied to something different. And even then, it's so hard in 5 seconds to come up with a better answer than your first one that I almost always go with it. So the only time I change is if, like, they say a title, you know, that I can, like, a clue that I can completely associate with someone else.
All right, we'll do one more question, and then I think we'll call it a night. Yeah, sure. Question if anyone's ever used a sports psychologist.
So my second player at Penn has sort of taken it upon himself to be our sports psychologist for the year. I don't think he like printed out like a fake diploma or anything, but I mean he spent the time to sort of read up on that sort of thing and about like how to, you know, like how to think, like in certain situations, like how like snacks is apparently a thing that helped us greatly this year. So never a professional, but it does make a difference in some places, but never beyond that.
I know that if a couple toss of bonus cycles would go by without my team getting any, I would turn to my teammates and say, "Hey guys, let's get some toss ups, all right?" And then I'll say, okay.
And then I'd get the toss-up.
Yeah, don't do that. You want my opinion.
One year, I won't say what year, we had some players that knew a lot, who were really good, but when they would get to the final crucial match, they would misspeak, they would get nervous, two of the players in particular.
It's so much a game of very fine distinctions between, like, very high performance and also of confidence, okay? And if you slip in those things, like I said, it's easy to embarrass yourself.
Personally, I don't ever have a confidence problem. I think people have seen me play enough that, like, I just don't care. I put it out there. And when other people are like, well, how do you do that? I'm just, I don't care. It's just a game. I'm just playing a game. It's fun. I'm sure the pressure has gotten to me, but I don't ever think about it. But yeah, I've seen that in my own players too. And I always tell them, like, it's just confidence. Just play the questions. It's just you and a dude reading questions. Just play the questions. The moment, it's not only not big enough for you, it just isn't there. It's just you and a question. So.
Let's do one more, actually. I think we got a little more time if someone has anything good. Yeah. Mike's trying hard to find a question. Okay. Okay, let me just toss something out real quick then. As far as things that other people have said, and I guess to get more specific since it's actually preserved and somewhat easy to find, what other people posted on HS Quiz Bowl, are there any posts that you think would be really helpful for people to read? And I'll answer my own question and start off with, because I'm egocentric. Mike Shane wrote a post about how to be a fourth player. And I know that that can come across as who wants to be the fourth player. But when you're in a tight situation, and let me tell you, with this set of nationals this year, if you're a top 20 team, you're going to be in tough situations because it's a wide open year. Being able to look over at that fourth guy and know that they are actively contributing, that they know how to play the game, and they know how to pull an answer when a lesser player would not, that can swing a game very easily, and having someone like that on your team is definitely a good thing. So I would definitely suggest finding that thread. Anyone else?
I will not let Max be egocentric and point out for him that Max has written a number of very lengthy and useful posts on numerous things that quiz bowlers need to deal with.
Yeah, so I like my posts. I don't know if other people like my posts. But my posts, which may or may not be good, and a lot of other posts, which I know are actually good, are all in there's a forum on the High School Quiz Bowl forums, you know, the best of the best forum. It's right at the top. It's, like, impossible to miss if you just go to the website. And there's a lot of good threads in there that are almost all worth reading.
Question.
To what extent do new players use writing questions as a studying strategy, and is the way you approach clues learning information different when you're using that way?
Okay. This will be a good one to close out on. The question was, how do you use writing questions to improve at the game? Like, how do you use that information, and how do you put that forward when you're playing questions in the future?
So contra Max, I'm actually not a flashcarder at all. This year I really tried to do the whole flashcard thing because I'd had it sold to me, like, by several different people. I just couldn't get into it. The thing that actually helped me the most was question writing. Like, the big thing that sort of got me from, you know, a not very good player to, like, a middling and better player was my teammate and I at the time said, we're going to write, like, this sort of novice level college tournament, and we sort of forced ourselves to write, like, 5 packets each, like, of each category. I'm not suggesting that, like, you have to do this, but this is sort of what helped me, and that sort of got me started. And then from then on, like, writing questions was sort of the way I got better, because I felt like that not only was I, like, learning new things, I also felt like I was sort of staying ahead of the clues as well. Like, I felt like I was, especially for the categories that I cared a lot about, like, I would actually go out of the way to find interesting and new clues that either weren't in my archive or I hadn't seen before. And I think this was very helpful. I think it's important, though, that if you write questions, you write them in a way that's useful. I personally don't think writing, like, super short questions is helpful for me. I think actually sitting down and writing, like, long, like, carefully crafted questions was helpful for me, because it also sort of got me into the mind of, like, question writers as well. And what I mean is, like, I could, you know, after I started writing questions, I could kind of read a Wikipedia article or a book, and then sort of my mind would automatically highlight, you know, the kinds of things that would become clues. Like, for example, if you're reading about a historical event and there's like a funny anecdote of any kind, like if somebody has a funny name or something like, you know, sexually vulgar happens and during this thing, like, it will come up in a question somewhere. and so sort of my mind would automatically like latch onto those things, and I would remember them, and it was actually, you know, very helpful. I don't know if the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I think that writing questions is a very good like master class to go from being like pretty good to very good once you kind of already understand how Quizball works. The thing that I wanted to stress was how writing questions doesn't just help you like memorize lists of clues. Like, I mean, if writing questions does for you, then that's great. But the important thing for me that writing questions helped with was understanding the relationship between things, understanding how things connected. So the subjects that I would get most of my questions in would be history and physics. Both of those things, everything is connected to everything else. And so I was able to develop a lot better understanding of how those things fit together, what kinds of things were going to be talking to each other through writing questions than just through like reading other questions and distilling them into bullet point clues.
Yeah, it just seems to be the theme for the night. A corollary I forgot to mention was that this is especially important in subjects, as Joe said, like developing relationships is especially important in subjects where the knowledge doesn't really appear in bullet point form. Like, I found this is especially true for things like math and physics. Like, the way you sort of learn math and physics, at least in my experience, is you don't get like verbal clues and then associate them with an answer. Like, that's just not how it works. Like, if you're solving an equation in class, like if you're, you know, solving a titration curve or whatever, like the way that's going to be presented to you in a problem set is very different than the way it's going to be presented to you in a quiz bowl setting. And one thing that helped writing questions really helped me to do was sort of translate that knowledge into like a verbal sort of clue framework. And then that gave me like a split second edge over people that hadn't necessarily pre-made that translation in their minds. And I think that was actually incredibly helpful for my development.
Yeah. So for me, I've mentioned that I don't love writing questions as much personally for helping myself learn. I've always found that for me, it is way too much of, you know, my first stage, the like identifying new clues, and not enough of the second stage, the memorizing. So when I write questions now, if I want to like remember the clues, I like sometimes card them, and I find that helpful. That said, especially when you're like not as elite, it's very good if you want to be like a generalist to write a ton of questions, because you sort of force yourself to study things if you're not like doing that on your own already. For example, my senior year, I wrote an all literature side tournament because I was really interested in literature. And then, like, as it turned out, like 20 of the things I wrote on like got me like powers at HSNCT or PACE that year. So it was like a very good investment of my time. I don't know how much of that was, you know, because of writing the questions or just because I forced myself to, you know, if I just read the Wikipedia articles for all those same things, like it would have worked as well. But, you know, I mean, again, it's, you know, a personal thing. Additionally, like, questions are awesome because like people need to write questions for other people to be able to play questions. So like at the very least, you'll learn, you'll become a better question writer, and like you'll be able to use them in some set that will like, that's the only way this game keeps going around, if everyone writes questions.
So. Okay, 2 points about that, and this will take 10 seconds. One is, when you write questions, you want to write in a variety of areas. I feel like a lot of people just write about stuff they already know. And if you're writing to learn and grow, that's not a good strategy. You should write about things you perhaps don't already know, maybe even things you're already only somewhat interested in. The second thing is, you want to have collaborators when you write. You don't just want to write your own questions and have them sit there in isolation. Before I was a writer of any caliber, I undertook to edit a college tournament, which turned out surprisingly well. I was very lucky. I had some very good submissions. That is what made me grow as both a writer and a player. That was like my quantum leap, because I saw like, okay, this is how these dudes are thinking when they write questions. But it was the interaction with like their thoughts that catalyzed my mind. If I were sitting there writing my own questions, it would have taken me much longer to make that same breakthrough. So find someone who knows how questions should work and communicate with them when you're writing. Don't just write alone in isolation. Do that too, but not exclusively.
I guess that's it. Well, I just want to thank everyone for coming out. I want to thank everyone that was on our panel and thank them for their thoughts and their time. And hope everyone had a good time, learned something. And best of luck to everyone that's playing tomorrow and Sunday. All right, thank you.